Hey, this is Tierney. You're about to listen to me in conversation with Paula Kahn. Paula Kahn is a community organizer from Los Angeles. She does extensive work regarding migrant justice, the war on drugs, and environmental rights. She is the co-founder of Cosmovisiones Ancestrales, an organization founded in 2018 to build bridges between indigenous communities, psychedelic researchers, mental health professionals, drug policymakers, psychedelic consumers, and populations that have been acutely impacted by the legacies of colonialism, slavery, war, and forced migration. Paula is passionate about making ancestral plant medicine available to people who have been subjected to state violence. Paula is currently running to represent California's Congressional District 30. At 26, Kahn is inspired by the powerful young women of color currently pushing for progress in Congress, especially Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar, and is sick of trusting strangers to protect her community. The 30th District encompasses the San Fernando Valley, the multicultural Los Angeles suburb, where Paula and I both grew up and attended high school together. Paula is looking to take the congressional seat in the 30th District from the incumbent, Representative Brad Sherman, who has received campaign finance money from weapon manufacturers in the past. He's represented this district since 2013, and Paula believes it's time for some fresh ideas in the 818. Somehow, someway, Paula made time for us in mid-November to talk about her campaign, her nonprofit, and the movements she devotes her life to. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. It is a Monday afternoon in Los Angeles, and I'm here in Margo Padilla's studio with the one and only Paula Kahn.
Hi, everyone.
Yes.
Grateful to be joining you all today.
We're so lucky to have you, Paula. I know you're plenty busy with your campaign, and I'm sure you were busy even before your campaign, so thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
So a little context is Paula and I went to the same high school together.
Yes.
In the San Fernando Valley, where Paula is now running her campaign for congressional seat.
That's right. Coming for you, Brad Sherman.
Right. I feel like we went to a pretty non-traditional high school in terms of having community organizers on campus. Do you feel that way? And do you feel that kind of the spirit of Cleveland where we went informed how you entered the world after that?
Yeah. And I love that's where we're starting. Yeah. I recently reached out to one of our educators for support on the campaign, and Miss Hill started organizing amongst core teachers to collect signatures to help get me on the ballot. And I visited Cleveland 2 weeks ago, and it was so magical to thank our educators for setting me up on this path for empowerment. And it really was at Cleveland Humanities Magnet where I first became aware of the systems of oppression based on gender, race, class that target people disproportionately. And we were given so many tools to respond to the oppression that we face. So I would certainly say that it was the core humanities magnet at Cleveland High School that set me up for success in this campaign. So it was such a blessing to thank our educators and for all the tools that they put in,
in our That's cabinet. So beautiful. I got such like fulfillment chills when you said Miss Hill is organizing for you, because I feel very similarly that just, I mean, how would we have known? You know, I think a lot of these like isms and systems of oppression have become increasingly visible to the mainstream, both in terms of like how they play out, but also the language of feminism versus intersectional feminism and racism, Islamophobia. But the fact that, like, 2010, 2011, we were having those kind of conversations in school with not just at school, but with these, like, trusted experts and community leaders in their own right. It's super beautiful how that impacts a lot of alumni from Cleveland.
Totally. And it was actually alumni that returned to Cleveland that started an after-school program called Taking Action, which was a space particularly for students of color to spend time in on Fridays after school. And that's where I was introduced to community organizing. And that's where I was informed on mass incarceration and the school-to-prison pipeline and the prison industrial complex. And that initiative was started by Patrice Cullors, Mark Anthony Johnson, and a lot of Carla Gonzalez, and a lot of incredible alumni from the program. And that really set me on the path to community organizing. So I thank them so from my heart.
Right.
Thank you.
And you're modeling that same kind of spirit in this way where those folks didn't just enjoy the educational benefits of the program, but they created a program to further bolster that community that has set you on a certain path, which is so beautiful. And some of that, even for people who weren't involved in those programs, that discourse existed on campus because of those programs. So things like the Bus Riders Union is like kind of part of that organization and offered a lot of community trainings and facilitation workshops back in the day for a lot of my peers. But through that, I was made aware of like public transportation in Los Angeles and like kind of criminalizing poverty in certain ways through fare hikes and fare policies. And I feel like as I listened to the conversation about, you know, riding the subway without paying in New York and how crazy that relates to like imprisonment, it's interesting to have all that context in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, thinking about how the revolution in Chile is also has been initiated by the fare hikes and just
right.
thinking about how public transportation can really be a catalyst for social change.
And speaking of public transportation, I saw you post recently sort of signaling that as a candidate, you're probably among few of the candidates who are taking public transportation far and wide to different obligations, political obligations or experiences across Southern California. Like, what have you been up to in the last week, per se, or what kind of experiences or organizations have you checked out in the last week?
In the last week. So I guess I'll work my way backwards.
Yeah.
On Saturday, there was a protest in downtown LA. It was a dance protest. It was called Amazon Uprising, organized by Good Money and a wider coalition of environmental justice orgs here in Los Angeles. And it was organized, I believe, by some members of the Burning Man community that are super activated in response to the fires that are happening in the Amazon and in response to the corporate financing of deforestation and animal agriculture and attacks on the indigenous community in Brazil. And so these folks have organized a protest and brought an art car to the financial district. And there were stops that happened at Chase Bank and Wells Fargo and other places. And there was a website, I believe, if you go to AmazonUprising.org or 5MillionTrees.org, you can sign up to join the movement. And Good Money will invest in the planting of 200 trees per sign up.
Oh, cool.
Definitely worth looking into and asking them how they're financing that. But yeah, it was beautiful. I spent the day there. They also had some artists such as Santa Gold and Naco Bear play later in the evening. And it was beautiful to get together in a joyful context to send a message to the big banks and to show that there is people power on a Saturday that are demanding that they divest from the deforestation and the ethnocide and genocide happening in the Amazon. And after that, I took the bus all the way to Long Beach from downtown to go to the California Democratic Convention. And I had done that the previous evening as well after a full day of work.
Wow. That's the true. I mean, bringing like a campaign that involves working class people and people who take public transit and people who aren't necessarily currently represented in Los Angeles Congress.
Yeah.
How was the California Democratic campaign or convention?
Yeah, California Democratic Convention. And for me, this is all super new. So I'm finding myself like trying to become as literate as possible in federal, state politics and local politics and all that jazz. So basically, it's different caucuses that make up the Democratic Party, or like people who have who are under the Democratic Party, who are Democratic voters, that's the right way of phrasing it. I'm not sure. But anyways, there's a bunch of caucuses depending on issues or identity, population groups. So there's a women's caucus, there's an LGBTQ caucus, environmental caucus, veterans caucus, and they all get together and make decisions on who they'll be endorsing, and people have an opportunity to make announcements about certain pieces of legislation. And then you have some of the like politicians themselves who are coming to greet folks and to also make speeches. And there was also a forum with presidential candidates. So it's an opportunity for politicians to engage with their voters.
And their party in this more person-to-person way. Mm-hmm. And was there anyone in particular that you heard speak or that you connected with at the convention that felt particularly empowering or interesting to you in terms of your own campaign?
Absolutely. I was able to see Representative Nanette Barragan speak before the Latino caucus.
Yeah.
And I learned that when Nanette became elected to the House of Representatives, she was the only Latina to get elected in 2016 onto the House of Representatives.
In the entire country.
In the entire country. And then in 2018, there were six more Latinas that were elected into the House of Representatives, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being one of them.
Yes.
But that's really not enough.
No, I mean, there's so many members of Congress, isn't there? I mean, it's not a tiny group for there to be such small numbers.
Exactly. And so I actually had the pleasure and honor of meeting her in Tijuana when I was volunteering there last year. Mm-hmm. And she enforced the right to seek asylum at the border in a coordinated action to ensure that some people who were an imminent threat in Tijuana could get through. And we worked together on that action. So it was the first time I met her. So it was incredible to see her again and to tell her, hey, like, after what we've witnessed in Tijuana, I'm going to run for Congress.
Right. And how you're both continuing to build your own movements around similar issues and values.
Right.
Do you feel like your time at the border and your time as a facilitator and advocate for people who are looking for freedom of movement and immigration has been one of the like largest motivators for your campaign right now?
Yeah, it's why I haven't given up. The atrocities that I witnessed in Tijuana, the atrocities I observed happening inside detention centers and learned about through testimony have driven me to run for office because I believe the incumbent is not doing nearly enough of what is possible to do in such a position of power.
Right. And what does that look like for you? What needs to be done more actively in terms of those issues and especially at the border?
So I don't understand how we're increasing funding for immigration customs enforcement and customs and border patrol when there have been so many deaths inside of ICE and CBP custody. This is definitely genocide, ethnocide happening, institutionalized, paid by taxpayer funding. We need to completely end the Remain in Mexico policy because that's actually putting people in greater danger. The cartels are abducting people, extorting people, and there's just a lot of organized crime. I call it intergovernmental organized crime, and I believe that people are being forced to migrate because U.S. taxpayer dollars are being utilized for military aid that is weaponizing narco-fascists, narco-dictators that are forcing people to migrate north. People get lost along the migration route to organized crime. And then those that make it along the U.S.-Mexico border are still in danger because of organized crime. But then if we think about the U.S. migrant detention system, that's just another form of organized crime. And it's also being paid by taxpayer money. And the things that are happening inside detention centers, there's no mechanism of accountability to hold people doing harm accountable for sexual violence, for medical negligence, for depriving people of nutritious food, for depriving people of water. We don't even keep track of the people that are coming through. There's no way to keep track of people sometimes once they're in the system, and the way they get transported from detention center to detention center, if they're sick, by the time that it's for certain that they need medical attention, sometimes it's too late. And that's why we've been seeing more deaths happening in custody. So I talk a lot about the just transition, and the just transition is a shift from an exploitative, extractive economy, a global war economy, to a cooperative, regenerative network of local peace economies. And we really need to phase into abolishing ICE detention and transitioning people that are operating in these roles of officers, ICE officers, whether they're CBP or ICE, or whether they work for private prison companies such as GEO or CCA. They're going to need jobs in order to leave their jobs at these companies that enforce genocide.
Right.
And then the people who are coming out of detention, they need jobs and mental health too. I like to think that if we all work together on land regenerative projects and we work together on water security, food security, extreme weather event preparedness, and planting trees, and at the same time had a huge investment in public health, mm-hmm. in mental health services, we could potentially start to restore and reconcile all of the harm that's happened in the past decade.
Right. And you know, on your website, you mentioned this fact, which is, like, if U.S. taxpayers are paying over, you know, $100, $145 a day for each adult, and so much for each child confined to these spaces, it's like, why is it everything going so bad? How could it be so crazy? And these aren't very specific reactions, I know, and how I'm phrasing it, but just like, I feel the level of atrocity in these immigration facilities and ICE centers is so horrific that you know, in a typically American fashion, like, it's really hard for people to even look at it with clear eyes or with a clear consciousness, you know. People want to suppress, I think, what's going on there just to simply get through their day, which is obviously problematic in some degree, but it's also kind of, it makes sense. But I feel like, I guess I'm curious if you could go into a little bit more about, like, how people are profiting from that. And I think that's part of the conversation that doesn't get included a lot, which is, like, just like the war or the wall, there's incentive for these things to continue happening because people are making money. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a legislative council called ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. I forget what exactly it stands for. Wrote about them in my thesis about 4 or 5 years ago. They're a group that is composed of profiteers, so the CEOs of some of these for-profit companies that have profited from the immigrant detention and deportation industry, and as well as lawmakers. So literally, members of Congress and senators who are also in this group, ALEC, and together they crafted the policies that would increase policing and crimmigration, that is the criminalization of immigration. And so they coordinated together. So, and some of these relationships are familial relationships, like there's familial ties. So there will be someone in office, and then one of their family members will be on the board of one of the companies that's profiting. So it's really, it's a group of people conspiring to create the for-profit system to profit off of people's misery of seeking safety and, you know, just being safe. And so what happens is that the government issues contracts with these companies, and they pay a significant amount of money that gets allocated from the Department of Defense budget, mm-hmm. and the ICE budget and the CBP budget, and they get contracts. These private companies get contracts, and because they're private companies, they don't have to be. There's no clear way to hold them accountable. There's no mechanism for accountability for these private corporations. They don't have to answer to anyone, and that's a lot of legal battles are happening right now.
With being able to even get a clear sense of the truth of the situation right now.
Yes. Yes. And so in my experience last year, I was accompanying someone I met in Tijuana, an indigenous environmental activist from Honduras, and he was confined in the Adelanto Detention Center here in Southern California. And that's a facility run by GEO. And GEO is a private company. It's one of the, it's the company with the biggest contract with the U.S., with ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. And so there was some human rights violations that were being waged on my friend. And so I would call and it was so informal. Like, you know, sometimes people would answer, they wouldn't give me, the GEO staff wouldn't give their name. So sometimes I was being answered and I'd be like, who am I talking to? And they would give a pseudonym, like Captain something, like, and it would be a joke. And I would be, you know, seeking to file a complaint because
of the mockery of your inquisition.
Certainly. And so they would put me on hold for a really long time. Sometimes the phone would hang up on its own, and sometimes they would just like they would say, oh, this person's not in, like they would just kind of like all withdraw from responsibility, like no one had responsibility. They would all kind of point the finger at each other, and there was no one that I could speak to because some higher up would be out on another operation somewhere, or And then so I had to file a civil liberties and civil rights complaint with Immigration Customs Enforcement, and I never heard back. I had to reach out to the local LA ICE field director, and I didn't hear back. I drove multiple times to Adelanto in person, and I demanded to speak to like the person of highest authority, both with ICE and GEO, and I was made to wait hours. Wow. Sometimes I was told that no one was in that day, so they give you the runaround.
As if, like, oh, they just left the whole operation solo for the day.
So I've noticed that they circulate roles and positions of authority, and I think that's super strategic because then no one falls under culpability.
Right.
And that's going to be important in the future when these abusers are brought to justice. Everyone's going to be like, well, I wasn't the one who made the order. I wasn't the one. I was just
part of a delegation with all these people, and it was all shared.
I was just following orders.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, though, how you do. I mean, you're a very compassionate and intelligent person, and you already like, I like how you already identify why some Americans work at these facilities and sort of indicating that that's not necessarily the problem. Like, the problem is that they exist with these lucrative contracts, and that this is literally an industry, and that there are progressive labor creation opportunities that could easily kind of take on this type of labor, you know, give these people jobs, basically. And with your friend, did they remain in that facility, or is there anything without violating their privacy that you can share about what happened with their journey?
Yeah, thank you for asking. And my friend has provided consent to share their story with what they went through at Adelanto. And this is why it's so important for us to work towards shutting down Adelanto as well as all the other facilities. My friend was released in July, thankfully, and I sponsored them out. And that's been a journey in and of itself. But the people that are pipelined into working for GEO mm-hmm. and other private companies are poor folks that don't have other economic opportunities, that likely haven't had access to higher education. And so it's actually quite sophisticated the way that profiteers, genocidal profiteers, have designed the system, because they will place these private detention centers in rural communities where there is very little economic opportunity, there's little access to education. And so if one of your few economic opportunities in which you receive benefits, including healthcare, dental, whatnot, is to work at a detention center, you're going to do it so that you can ensure that your family's provided for. And it's quite sad. I mean, going to visit Adelanto, I would see people, you know, just like you and me, but in uniform, people who had tattoos, people who were our age, people of different races. And it's just terribly sad to hear that these folks are dehumanizing other people that are here seeking asylum, that speak different languages, that, you know, are just like them, but don't speak English and haven't been here since they were born. And it's just terribly sad that because people lack the education and then are pipelined into these jobs where they do have to distinguish themselves and another group of people. And it's incorporated in the policy of their job that they have to deprive people of their basic human rights, that then it just becomes normalized that they just participate in cruel acts of humor and bully people to the point where it surpasses what is beyond any idea of what a joke actually is and what actual oppression and violence
abuse,
is.
Yeah,
it's really sad.
And then, of course, there's the element of the children and, like, separation from families and what, over 70,000 children have been detained or something like that at this point. You mentioned the need for accountability and culpability in the future and the idea that sort of airing the truths of what's happening right now, this ongoing history of, like, genocide right now, as something to be looked at in the future. Like, do you see yourself leading a campaign like for truth and reconciliation, or for folks who aren't as familiar with like what a truth or reconciliation commission does? Can you explain how that kind of fits into like historical memory or human rights?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So truth and reconciliation commissions or truth and memory commissions have been issued in supposedly post-conflict societies during a stage of what is called transitional justice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's like an official announcement, okay, like we have ended.
One big bad thing is done, but you say post as supposedly because obviously that's not finished right then and there or whatever.
Right. So. It's not always so clear cut when conflict ends.
Apartheid's over.
Right. It just keeps bleeding out, you know, in different ways. So, yeah, one of the first Truth and Reconciliation Commissions happened in South Africa, post-apartheid supposedly, but we all know that there's still racialized segregation happening there.
Yeah.
And then there has also been a truth commissions in Guatemala as well. And in general, it's something, there's been a strong model for these commissions in Latin America. So in Argentina and Chile, sometimes it looks like in the form of a museum where one can view all of these different items that can educate the public on the atrocities that have been committed during acts of authoritarianism so that we never forget what has happened. And it's to prevent, you know, the war on truth, because one of the first things that gets attacked when there's an authoritarian regime in power is the truth. You know, there's a war on truth. And we've seen that. We've seen that from the very beginning of this administration. And so, you know, every day we're being gaslit by the people who have stolen power. So I think one of the things I would focus on is immediately we need to close down those concentration camps. There's no monitoring. There's very little monitoring, but there are some community groups, national community efforts to monitor conditions inside. So, yeah, we do need a Truth and Commissions Act. To seek justice, to get clarity on what people have gone through from their migration route, why they left, also why they left their countries of origin. Because if we listen enough to those testimonies, we learn that there's some interesting connections on how those narco governments are getting financed, mm-hmm. who the profiteers are of the mega projects that are forcing indigenous people off of their lands. And it all comes back to U.S. military aid and other imperial powers intervening in countries that are resource rich.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that is something that definitely gets eroded from the conversation about like migration, immigration in America, is that the general American public, or like through mainstream news or education systems, don't often enough have an idea of how American imperialism undermines or interjects itself into the history and realities of all these different places that immigrants are coming from. And I think that is just such a key piece of the puzzle to strategically not amplify in the U.S. because it's like very clearly washing our hands of this legacy and kind of problematizing it in a way as if all these stories begin at the border or begin on American land when these stories are so much longer, as you say.
I just find it super ironic that Donald Trump accuses people from the global south of being drug traffickers, human traffickers, being rapists, when in fact it's this system that he is hellbent on expanding that actually puts people in further risk of being trafficked, that puts people at further risk of being co-opted by organized crime. And especially when he is so aligned with other fascists like Jair Bolsonaro or Juan Orlando Hernandez and other people in power in Central America, it just blows my mind that he can endorse narco governments while also criminalizing people that are fleeing these narco governments. And how dare he call people coming from the global south rapists when he, in fact, thinks that he can just grab someone by the pussy and get away with it.
Right.
So just, putting up that mirror to Donald Trump.
Definitely. And in terms of, kind of truth tribunals, do you want to speak? I know you've had experience on such a coalition, haven't you, in regards to the Iraq War?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Tell me about that, because I think that is very – I think truth gathering around post-9/11 America and Iraq was something very – interesting and timely while we were in high school together in such a kind of progressive politicized environment. At least for me, there was conversation around that I wasn't receiving anywhere else, you know what I mean, in terms of even basic facets of that administration. I know I'm not know how to say it. Just basically getting all of our privacy all the time. The Patriot Act.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. That's all part and parcel of the same thing, but or the same period. But in regards to the Iraq War, what was the People's Tribunal?
I just have to take a moment to laugh because I was just talking to my dad the other day about how we're about to close out a decade and it's about to be 2020 and what a fucking millennia it's been.
Right.
What a shit show.
So crazy.
So, yeah, literally 1 year into the new millennia, we were children and 9/11 happened and we, as children.
Wow. That's really crazy. I haven't thought of that as such a bookend to this time, but it is.
Yeah, it was super, I would say it was super defining to our lives, the majority of our lives. And we were so disempowered as children to have any agency at the time. And working on the People's Tribunal on the Iraq War through Code Pink, I was invited to join Code Pink in producing this tribunal. It became a huge learning opportunity for me because I was totally uninformed and wasn't seeking out information on the circumstances that led to the Iraq War. And so the two-day event was framed as day one, testimonies were going to be delivered on the lies that led us to the war. And day two would be testimonies delivered on the costs, not just the financial costs, the moral costs, the physical costs of all of the bloodshed that occurred and all of the illness that was produced by depleted uranium. And so just how intangible one can even calculate. And so my role was to recruit people from different walks of life to participate in delivering testimony. So I was reaching out to Iraqis. I was reaching out to families of veterans and those who lost their lives fighting this senseless war. I was reaching out to environmentalists who could testify to all of the biodiversity that was destroyed in the war. I spoke with doctors who could testify to all of the cancers and deformations that occurred because of the depleted uranium, and scholars, activists, people who resisted the war when all of the warmongering was happening. And yeah, there was a lot of profits that were made by Dick Cheney's company. I can't quite remember it right now. Eric Prince, you know, all of these weapons manufacturers and profiteers. And of course, one of the interesting... There's a lot of chisme around this, and I'm really
all
grateful.
All the good chisme.
Right. And 9/11, the war in Iraq, has everything to do with the creation of ICE because, it's an opportunity to critically nerd out and activate whoever's listening. So the private prison industry... you know, started surging again in the 80s, but, we kind of got to go back to the 60s. There was the 1960s, you know, the civil rights movement that, you know, the conservatives needed some tactic to destroy and dismantle the civil rights movement. And so Nixon got the idea to create a war on drugs. And so people were policed for marijuana use, opiates use. Communities of color were disproportionately policed and incarcerated. There was a war waged on the Black Panthers and other radical revolutionaries. And meanwhile, while these attacks were happening, the U.S. was also funding dictatorships abroad in Latin America, for sure, and other places. And so while this was all happening, you know, fast forward a little bit to the 80s and the crack epidemic happens, another attack on communities of color. Obstructing their kind of stupefying communities. That's the way I see it when substance proliferation strategically happens by the government to stupefy communities, to deactivate them from organizing to transform the oppression that they face. I see it as having a stupefying effect. So during the 80s, that happens while the private prison industry is expanding. And then during the 90s, private prisons start kind of filling out, and they start kind of emptying out a little bit. So then by the early 21st century, there needs to be like a premise for which to, increase incarceration to fill those private prisons that have been emptying out. And the war on terror became one of the mechanisms through which private prisons could be filled up again, because after 9/11, what happens with the Patriot Act and a bunch of folks from the Middle East, South Asia, North Africa get funneled into prisons. And that's when we start seeing again like a huge regime of deportation for people that are stereotyped and criminalized as terrorists and national security threats. And soon after 9/11 happens, ICE is created in, I believe, 2003. And then not long after that, there's the war on drugs that's formally announced, like the more contemporary war on drugs in 2006. And both of these mechanisms just create this new, like, these two new endless wars that are going to generate so much profit from the weapons manufacturing industry, that are going to expand the Department of Defense, that are going to funnel taxpayer money into all of these contracts that are going to happen. And what's happened since then is that we've just seen so many people pipelined into prisons, and we've seen a lot more people ill in our communities. We've seen a lot of broken communities because of these wars.
Yes, thank you so much. And like, in terms of your campaign right now in the Valley, how does like the war on drugs stuff come up? Is it more just like an ideological stance, or do you feel like that's an activated area that really like needs this?
Yeah, I think the war on drugs is relevant to local politics in the San Fernando Valley because we are seeing a rising number in unhoused people in the San Fernando Valley. The housing crisis is ubiquitous and it's concerning, and a lot of people on our streets are also self-medicating, and we need a comprehensive public health response. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand why people are using and self-medicating, and we need compassionate responses, and we need to create a pathway for whether it's transitional housing or more permanent affordable housing solutions, they also need to be supplemented by supportive care for communities that are unhoused, that are drug-using communities. We just have to face the reality, and we need to destigmatize drug use and talk more about harm reduction.
Totally. And as the incumbent representative in the seat that you're campaigning for, how do you feel Brad Sherman has responded to this growing need, both in terms of the housing crisis and homelessness in the Valley, and also the public health consequences of that?
I sense a lot of silence from him on issues. He has been vocal about impeachment from a very early stage. But when it comes to issues like housing, housing is a human right, or Medicare for all, or student debt relief, medical debt relief, free tuition for higher education, I sense some
silence. Right. I'm like, I haven't heard anything. You know, this is somebody who has represented the district that I grew up in and that I currently live in and I've lived in for a couple years of his. So as a progressive candidate new to campaigns of this nature, do you feel that competing with the financial support Congressman Brad Sherman receives as an incumbent, is that one of the largest challenges that you're facing right now?
Pretty much. I'm not a corporately financed candidate. I am working off of individual contributions from average people like you and myself.
Yeah.
And so he happens to receive funding from corporate banks and established corporations. In the past, he's received funding from Northrop Grumman, which is a weapons manufacturer that has a site in Canoga Park, which is in the district.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't be receiving any money from the security and arms industry. I won't be receiving any money from the from the banking industry. And here it's important to note that, you know, I would hope that we, regardless of what our politics are, whether we think voting is worth it, you know, whether voting is whether the electoral system is legitimate or illegitimate, we just can't have a representative that has a code of ethics that relies on the funding of a weapons producer, because weapons are made to kill. And I'll say this, Northrop Grumman hasn't developed a human rights policy to track the weapons that it sells to foreign governments. So there is no way of tracking where the weapons that Northrop Grumman sells to foreign governments, where those weapons get used, where they are. And he received money from the profits of this company that has no human rights policy. So I'm sorry, Brad, you don't represent us in the Valley when we are seeing a rise in gun violence. When there's gun violence abroad and there's gun violence locally, we just have to take action and just set boundaries where representatives just should have never been funded. And like, it's actually so embarrassing that you receive funding from a weapons manufacturer at a time when there's so much armed violence that you just really need to like pass the mic on to someone else and just
right.
Not even.
I think he's very representative without it being personal, but just in terms of the policy that has been enacted and then the platforms that you're both currently running on or looking to run on. I feel like he kind of embodies this like centrist Democrat, centrist liberal perspective that maybe it kind of controls a lot of the Democratic Party as we often think of it. And then I feel like there are new players, especially in Congress, that are representing a little bit more of a progressive or leftist or however you want to indicate these values or something, you know, from that kind of place. And I'm just wondering, like, do you feel that the spirit of the times right now allows for perhaps a more progressive liberal spirit in Congress versus the kind of liberal Democrat platform that we've seen in Congress people like Brad Sherman?
Absolutely. Just the fact that we've seen so much momentum and enthusiasm around the squad,
right.
members of the squad, has really motivated a lot more femmes, a lot more queer folks, a lot more people of color to run for office. And that's really inspiring. I think right now we're realizing that we can't afford literally the Intergovernmental Climate Commission, if I'm not mistaken,
yeah.
that's the acronym. They told us in October of 2018 that we have 12 years to transform our relationship to the environment and to energy. Otherwise, there will be unprecedented human suffering. And there already is. And my analysis on contemporary global climate catastrophe is that we are seeing the consequences of colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade. So we really, we need a diversity of tactics to obstruct the genocidal forces that continue to wage ecocide, femicide, ethnocide, epistemicide, and ultimately the extermination of life on Earth. And I believe that's why we're seeing more enthusiasm around alternative candidates that are really pushing the envelope on what kind of change, what kind of social change is possible.
Thank you. And I feel like illustrating that also points to one of the many ways in which sort of democratic voters, let's say, who are perhaps not as left as some thinkers, but who are looking for literally just the earth to continue on going, okay, are looking to candidates who are perhaps more progressive or leftist than these voters might have thought about voting for or supporting in the past, that now, because of the simple reality of like acknowledging the imminent threat of climate change and like climate crisis, that I feel like that's one of the touchstones of a platform like yours, where you'd be able, or you are able to connect with a larger range of voters. That's just kind of my conjecture. How do you feel about like the way Mayor Eric Garcetti serves LA, especially in regards to immigration and homelessness? Like, is there a ton of value to being a sanctuary city? Like, because LA isn't really a sanctuary city, but the city council like calls us the sanctuary city. What do you think about that?
I'm really disappointed. I feel like there's a lack of willpower. I don't understand, and this goes for Eric Garcetti as much as other politicians, I don't understand why there's such a high number of people living on the streets who also are in need of sanctuary, who are also in need of a place of refuge, who are truly internally displaced people. And when we think of, terms in migration studies, internally displaced people are basically refugees within their own country's borders. And that's essentially what the unhoused population in Los Angeles, in the Bay Area, across the country, there's internal refugees, and then there's also folks seeking asylum at the border. And we need to expedite the massive construction of affordable housing without any like ifs, ands, or buts. Like, it's a question of willpower. It's not a question of whether the financing is there. When there is a human need, mutual aid is rested on the fact that people in communities take care of each other in order to guarantee each other's survival and health. There's no question of like, how will we raise enough money? It's a matter of just us working with what we have. Mm-hmm. So how can people who have access to so much wealth, who have relationships with developers, why don't they have the willpower to just get it done?
Right.
I don't understand.
Because they're motivated by personal financial gain.
Obviously.
And being invited to these people's mansions.
Yeah.
It's particularly embarrassing, I think. And of course, and as part of your campaign, you amplify this idea that the United States is too wealthy of a country for so many people to live in poverty. But just in particular, Los Angeles has so much wealth. We are like the hub of one of the most lucrative, entertainment is such a huge industry. And there's so many people who individually become so wealthy that It's disappointing and yet potentially hopeful, like that one day some of those resources can be plugged back into the community that a lot of these people move to in order to pursue their dreams. Los Angeles is a place that people come to dream and be creative and to like create themselves. And so it's particularly unfortunate that those who have success doing so aren't a little bit more reciprocal with those resources.
Absolutely. And just hearing you talk about housing reminded me, I went to a panel last week, I believe it was Monday or Tuesday, at the Skid Row Archive and Museum on Broadway. And there was an event on how do we fund the affordable housing that we need to house the unhoused population. And, you know, there was a few new terms that I learned about, tax credits being one of them, and also inclusionary zoning. And a way that we could transform the housing system, and in order to fund affordable housing, one of the tools in our toolkit would be to rezone downtown Los Angeles and require developers to build affordable housing through inclusionary zoning, which includes... Sorry, I'm just checking my notes here. LA
doesn't... Such valuable notes.
So if you take land used for industrial use and create value to rezone for luxury housing, this creates new value that's for profit. Extra value of that land can be created through public policy to be used for affordable housing, rezoning, inclusionary zoning, market rents. So I guess I would just look into inclusionary zoning for any housing enthusiasts out there.
Right.
And I also learned that we're in an optimal phase right now where the LA City Council is looking, is right now drafting its 2040 plan. So right now is like an optimal time to raise pressure on LA City Council to advance inclusionary zoning. And that would require developers to make affordable housing units in the same zones that they're creating those like huge luxury
shopping centers and skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a luxury shopping and creative business campus built walking distance from Skid Row in downtown LA called The Row. So, I mean, some, you know, inclusionary housing, like, geez, you know, we need these kind of measures desperately as soon as possible. And so I'm curious, how has it been putting yourself out there as a candidate, like coming from just thinking about your own personhood and your own lifestyle, has electing to pursue this path like amplified your busyness and your schedule? Has it always been a little bit crazy and filled with these kind of community and education moments? How are you feeling sitting amid this process?
Yeah, every day is a unique journey, and I do feel determined to give it all I have to make this, to set a precedent for other people, other working class people, other young femmes of color to challenge incumbents and to work towards representing their communities locally and regionally, mm-hmm. nationally. So I feel like I'm doing something that's just an experiment. It's a social experiment, and it's very challenging. It does make me very nervous because I could be spending my time in a myriad of other ways, but I just can't tolerate corruption anymore. I refuse to allow and to give permission to someone who I'm sensing is morally bankrupt to continue representing my district. I think we need a new vision, and I may not have as much experience as someone who is 26 years of age, but I have fresh vision, and I don't think there are any excuses to not bring visions into reality.
Right. And also, you do have experience directly protecting your community in a variety of capacities, which I think is something that we want from these representatives. And so there's just different types of experiences. You have sure hell of a lot of experiences Brad Sherman does not have.
Oh, so. Thanks. Got to brush my shoulders off.
Right. I love it. When you look at, you mentioned the squad, which is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and a few other congressional representatives that are all women of color. They're young, on the younger side, called the squad because they are so powerful, I think, that they've been, like, itemized as a little group within the group type thing. But some of these women have also experienced such intense ridicule, a criticism, you know, constant basically ridicule, criticism, attack from other people in government, from, you know, just American citizens corresponding with them in either the media or on social media. So, like, as a person running to be a politician, you know, do you ever feel concerned or curious about putting yourself into, like, that kind of position? Like, do you feel like it's vulnerable to amplify your own personhood in this context? And how do you feel like when you see the way some of these leaders are, like, depicted or critiqued in the media?
So I actually attended a pro-Trump event in Las Vegas last April where I was undercover.
Yes.
And learned of all of the hate that I was already familiar with a lot of the hate that that Representative Omar was the target of, but I wasn't aware that so much inciting of violence could happen in such a professional, quote unquote, professional environment. And I witnessed a lot of politicians and people in the Trump administration and people who endorse the Trump administration critiquing Ilhan Omar, accusing her of anti-Semitism and making fun of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in a way that was inciting violence on them. And also I remember that there was a tweet where Trump posted and pinned a video that was a collage of 9/11 as well as Ilhan Omar's words. And it was totally, it was really cheap propaganda. Like,
right.
It was really, I was just shocked at how the president of the United States could get away with posting something that would incite harm on a fellow representative of the people.
Totally.
And that's when I decided, you know, especially as a Jewish person, you know, I really want to make clear what is anti-Semitism, what isn't anti-Semitism, and what is white supremacy, because there is a stake for Jews and other targets of white supremacy to come together to denounce white supremacy, to identify it and disarm it. I don't understand it's not that I don't understand. I am very disappointed and disenchanted that that anti-Semitism becomes this becomes weaponized and used towards anyone who is critical of the violence that is being waged by the ethno-nationalist state of Israel, which is, it's just sad. But it's we really need to think about how we're going to demobilize, disarm, and reintegrate communities that are in armed conflict, and
yes,
accusing people who hold
truth or accountability for that conflict, conflating that with supporting anti-Semitism is extremely troublesome and also extremely powerful.
Right. In silencing people.
And I'm so glad you're Jewish, because I wasn't raised Jewish, but as somebody who has been to the West Bank, and I know you've visited Palestine yourself, I feel so lucky to have engaged with and to continue to engage with so many Jewish people who are actively resisting and opposing the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and who are among some of the leaders working coalitions with Palestinian people, of course, to you know, hold the government accountable, to increase global awareness of the reality, what happens there, to speak to this very point of, you know, refusing to conflate, like, opposing apartheid or opposing occupation with anti-Semitism. But I think that that narrative really gets diminished in American culture and for sure in American news, where we don't get to hear, we don't create platforms for Jewish folks to critique the Israeli government. And it's such a hot button issue. So I just really appreciate that you're able to call upon your identity as just someone who, like, for all the more reason to resist this type of thing.
Thank you. Yeah, I just, I worry on my father's side, we are the descendants of survivors of the Holocaust. And I actually just visited my sister's, my grandmother's sister, my great aunt, and she was forced to work for a German weapons manufacturing company through slave labor. And they would attempt to sabotage the corporation, the company, by trying to create empty bullets. So,
wow.
Yeah, I just recently visited her, and my great aunt has dementia now, and she still has flashbacks, and she's in her 90s. She has flashbacks from when she was in Germany. She was at the Theresienstadt labor camp, which was a model camp and actually resembles ICE facilities quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Because when human rights observers visit ICE facilities, they try to clean up and make it seem like it's a humane environment. So I hope if there are any Jewish listeners that are triggered by my critique of Israeli apartheid and ethno-nationalism, just please understand that it's because I am weary that we are falling in a trap where we are replicating conditions of genocide and ethnocide, and it's not okay.
Right. I remember I went to Israel and, Palestine, however you want to describe these lands, in 2012, and I just remember going to the Holocaust Museum and Remembrance Memorial towards the end of my trip. And when I left that space, which in a way functions as one of these truth bureaus that you speak of, I had this level of immense emotional reaction where I was reacting to all the stories and lives that I had just experienced in regards to the Holocaust. But having already spent time with Palestinians and Bedouins and Black Israelis, you know, African immigrants in Israel, that for those like couple weeks beforehand, there was this other level of gravity and horror, because I couldn't help but see the connections in the way that like genocidal strategy, you know, enacts itself, in the way that the war on truth and ideas, and how there, it's not to ever say that one, you know, catastrophic system is just mirroring another, but to be in that land, it's like a weird consciousness, right, of having so much regard for the spirituality of this place, the history of this space, the nationalism that was created there through, you know, colonial measures, but that was created with the idea of creating space for persecuted people. That isn't stuff for me to argue about, you know, but just the, I feel too much of the conversation stays in the past when there's daily, human rights abuse every single day in this region. And whether it's like the mirroring of how these centers look, or the same company building the walls in the West Bank that we build in California or in Texas, and these same kind of global contractors. It's very interesting to really have the space to talk about Israel and Palestine in the context of American politics.
Absolutely. And wow, you just really served some poetic justice and in your testimony. Yeah, I really value that you just brought up the companies that work on border construction with the separation barrier wall in the West Bank, and then the border expansion that's happening along the U.S.-Mexico border. Because in 2014, I remember witnessing the Gaza-Israeli war that was happening, and at the same time that the media was giving more attention to the mass migration of unaccompanied Central American youth. Mm-hmm. And I felt such a distinct pain in my heart, not understanding how this was happening when there were people with power that had access to capital and decision-making processes that I didn't have access to. And I didn't understand why our young Central American children migrating unaccompanied and then being put in jails, and why are Israeli missiles killing Palestinian youth in Gaza? Why is Gaza an open-air prison? And why is Central America turning into an open-air prison? I didn't understand, and I felt rage and I felt sadness. And my mom told me that one day she was going to help support me become an advocate for these issues. And unfortunately, she passed away from cancer around 6-7 months later, after we had many conversations that summer of 2014. And so, yeah, when I visited Palestine, Israel, the Holy Land that everyone can be a steward to, I noticed so many parallels. And something that would be important to emphasize is that there are raids that happen in Palestinian communities, mm-hmm. in the West Bank, where IDF soldiers or IOF soldiers, as some call them, Israeli occupation force. Yeah, they raid homes in the middle of the night, and they will violently rip youth from their families and take them into jails and interrogate them and deprive them of food, deprive them of sleep, put them in super cold and lit rooms, and will interrogate them and coerce them to admit to some wrongdoing. And many spend years incarcerated, months, days. And what this essentially does is sometimes it really breaks the trust that some youth have with their families. Mm-hmm. Many youth don't understand why they are indefinitely incarcerated, much like is happening in the U.S. And there's a resolution that has been crafted, H.R. 2407. It's to ensure that no U.S. military aid that's given to Israel is used on the mass incarceration of Palestinian children.
Wow. I didn't know about that bill, and I'm really glad for that, because that's the bottom, like not the bottom of the barrel, but that's just like one piece that we could at least ensure that, right? Because, I mean, our military aid budget and our money goes so much toward a lot of the oppression the Israeli government inflicts there. It's basically like the American government is totally bolstering it too. So it is like our conflict, I think, no matter where your heritage lies or if you've visited the place or not.
Yeah, I mean, we are sending $3.8 billion of U.S. military aid to Israel, so we really should be monitoring how that money gets
used. It's getting used, and that's how I would lobby conservatives when I would organize around these issues, because it's like, I mean, not to polarize what people's interests are, but some people are more moved by human rights violations and some people are more moved by their money, so
yeah,
both are at play. And I do feel like since I visited in 2012 that the national climate in America has expanded the voice for Palestinian people. It's not to say that there's been any great progress politically or policy-wise, but I do feel the cultural sentiment and the conversation happening, whether it's on, you know, Twitter or like just among youth especially, I do feel that there is a larger space made for the Palestinian experience than I had experienced prior to my trip or in the immediate years following. So that I am glad about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And whatever your individual political, like, whatever gets you to the ballot or gets you activated the most, whether it's ecological issues, prison issues, migration issues, I feel pretty strongly that however you feel, like whatever thing you care about the most in politics, there's like an easy parallel to the Palestinian conflict, and that you can like dig in. You know what I mean? There's something there for everybody. And I also just said Palestinian conflict, but one thing I do want to say that's like my little spiel is I don't usually tend to use that language because I feel I had always heard about occupation there referred to as the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I just feel that in our imaginations, that nomenclature really sets us up to see the conflict as two sides of a scale. And it's just absolutely ridiculous to like expect that as the reality when it's really like an occupation of one group of people by an immensely more powerful group of people, which is the Israeli government, you know? So I try not to conflate like the conflict or the disagreement with occupation and like apartheid government policy, basically. And as an American, as a, like, I went to Palestine so dumb, Paula. I can't. I really did.
Me too.
And it was one of the most, it was definitely like the most impactful experience of my life because it was a privilege to be able to go there so dumb and then to have such access to education. But something I left really thinking about is that as Americans, we're constantly educated to believe that it's a very complicated issue when we talk about whether we say conflict or occupation. And while there are tons of nuances to the individual and collective experiences of what happens there, I don't think like things like open air prison and apartheid checkpoints are very complicated issues. You know, I think as Americans, we need to let go of this idea that over there, you know, the big other of whatever happens, you know, with Palestinians and Israelis, like we need to stop thinking about it as this like huge stake, multi-layer issue that none of us could possibly understand or have an opinion about because there's a lot of practical realities that we can have an educated opinion about. Okay, so I want to circle back to the idea of the war on drugs. It's something that you fight and explore on so many different levels, both in the historic and now. But I remember from our conversation last year that you believe that anyone who's consumed a psychoactive substance does have a role to play in the movement, building work to end the war on drugs. So I want to talk about that because I think, yeah, most of us, whether it is caffeine or nicotine or alcohol, marijuana, mushrooms, ketamine, I mean, drugs are extremely popular and common. So I'm curious, like, how do you think the recreational culture of drugs like plays into or lends itself to the war on drugs movement?
Wow. I'm so excited to answer this question. So I was recently bartending at a music festival because I needed some supplemental
money, honey,
to fund this campaign.
Yeah.
So I was looking at some attendees' shirt and it said something like, "Are you on drugs?" Or it had something like implying that everybody was on drugs. And I just had this epiphany, you know, while I myself was also serving a substance to festival goers, that the drug consumers north of the U.S.-Mexico border are driving the demand for psychoactives that get produced often outside of U.S. borders. And I think we drive the demand, but as consumers, we're not necessarily taking up responsibility for the associated armed violence and territorial displacement and forced displacement of indigenous communities that are waged violence by cartels or organized crime. So I think drug users have a stake in ending the war on drugs because there's blood-stained cocaine that could actually just be cruelty-free cocaine. Can you imagine what vegan cocaine would be like?
So good, so pure.
You know, guilt-free cocaine.
Yeah.
And the funniest part of it all is, you know, we got to destigmatize these conversations. You know, just because I am in this race for a seat in the House of Representatives doesn't mean that I can't talk about drugs and drug use because guess what? George W. Bush was a cocaine user, but he never received any sort of policing or time in jail because of his drug use.
You know? Even intense media scrutiny.
Yeah, exactly. And so the war on drugs is this huge premise to lock people up. And something I'm just really concerned with is, and I frame this sometimes I'm speaking at festivals or at conferences, and I frame this as a sci-fi plot. Mm-hmm. Because here we are 500 plus years after conquest happened and contact happened between different civilizations. And one of those civilizations, members of, you know, continental Europe, decided that the spiritual medicinal knowledge of indigenous peoples throughout Abya-Yala, otherwise known as the Americas, was inferior or perhaps was so powerful and threatening beyond measure that they just didn't understand how far in advance they were in their knowledge systems, that it had to be exterminated. And rewind 500 plus years ago, and all of the healers in a society are murdered publicly, are assassinated in cruel ways where you just have to ask yourself, wow, someone had to have a very vivid imagination on how they were going to publicly torture someone and dismember them in front of their community as spiritual leaders. And the knowledge epistemicide occurred where people's knowledge systems were destroyed to, again, stupefy people into hierarchical systems of labor exploitation. And so over time, people were coerced into these systems of labor exploitation to produce maximized profit for the new global economy. And so while people were working in plantations, whether they were indigenous, African, Afro-Indigenous, The colonizers coerced people to consume marijuana, coca, caffeine, and alcohol in order to numb the emotional and physical pain of slavery. And so we can trace a lot of the conditions, the human conditions that are policed contemporarily through mass incarceration and through punishing poverty by tracing the ways in which people were pipelined into substance dependency through systemic labor exploitation. And that's just one of the aspects of the genealogy of the war on drugs. But then there's also the contemporary monopolization of the marijuana industry and what's already happening with psychedelics and what's has already happened with big pharma and opioids. And so you have you literally have campesinos, say, in Mexico, and campesinos in Colombia, potentially Peru. I don't know enough about Peru. But you have campesinos producing coca, producing the poppy plant. And then you have chemists, for example, in Mexico, that are purchasing the opium from the poppies, and then they export it to laboratories abroad, and then they produce the pharmaceutical product, and then it gets sold back to people at higher prices. So these campesinos that are producing the massive supply of painkillers are seeing the tiniest percentage of what the product ultimately gets turned into, refined into, and sold for. Meanwhile, they are coerced to produce for, you know, organized crime or whoever the intermediaries are that sell to the chemists and the companies. So those are some other aspects.
Yeah, totally.
There's a lot to be said, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's so much to be said that you did co-found a nonprofit in regards to a lot of this conversation, right? So Cosmovisiones Ancestrales, so meaning ancestral worldviews.
Yes.
So what is this the context that prompted this organization to be founded, or what kind of united you and your co-founders to create this?
So I was very lucky to attend the Plantas Sagradas Convergence in Ajijic, Guadalajara, Mexico in the spring of 2018. And there I attended panels where some indigenous community members spoke about different topics related to and historically indigenous stewarded medicinal plant medicine, Plantas Maestras, and I reached out to some folks that I felt very aligned with their work, and I expressed my interest in exploring how there could be efforts that would coalesce around supporting Indigenous communities in defending their territorial rights and ecosystems, and ensuring that the medicine and its stewards would be protected from violence, and also exploring the possibility of advocating for using plantas maestras in ceremonies to be used for processes of demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration, which refers to demobilizing armed conflict, that is intervening, active armed conflict, disarming, so literally incentivizing people to give up their arms that, you know, will lead to premature death, and reintegration, how people reintegrate into coexistence after harm has been done intra-communally.
Yeah.
So people were interested, and there was three different projects that were launched for each of the co-founders living south of the U.S.-Mexico border. And we also launched a fundraiser to fund the travel of the co-founders to come visit for the celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day in the fall of 2018.
That's awesome. You know, it's so weird. I feel like because so much of the colonial history of the relationship with these drugs and the kind of like legislation around them, it continues to play out in these sort of like racist ways where, for example, when we talk about psychedelics or even drug use, including cocaine, we often, when it's like in a positive or non-judgmental realm in society, it's usually because rich, like white tech quote pioneers, to continue colonial language, or entrepreneurs, or, you know, the classic like busy businessman does a chic line of coke on his like titanium counter. Like those are kind of like the normal, you know, the tech employee microdosing acid or shrooms, you know, or chemical psilocybin extracted from shrooms at his desk, you know, in Silicon Valley, I feel like, or even the creator who might work in these fields using these substances on the weekend to come down from all this data and screen time and mental cognition within like the rational brain. But it's pretty crazy that that's all kind of normalized, but that the idea of people who are migrating, immigrants, displaced people, refugees, the idea that these populations would benefit deeply from drugs is never discussed. People would think, like, first of all, you want to shut down the border facilities and you want to provide psychedelic support. I mean, that's something that I think is so beautiful, but it's just not a realm of conversation that most Americans are having right now. So I really appreciate the way you're like activating this work.
Yeah, I really appreciate you drawing attention to those goals that are on the horizon. I think that we really need to start thinking how we're going to support people who are at the front lines of state violence. And because there is so much momentum towards the decriminalization of psilocybin mushrooms, we need to broaden the conversation to become more detail-oriented and comprehensive in what that policy could look like. And I was actually just talking about this with a friend yesterday, because the Decriminalized California movement is building momentum quite fast. And we already saw the decriminalization in Denver, and we saw Decriminalized Nature pass in Oakland City Council. So there's a lot of momentum and excitement around this right now.
In regards to psilocybin, right?
In regards to psilocybin. In Oakland, it was also for hickory, which is peyote, and anything that grows from the ground. So that would also be San Pedro as well.
Cool.
And yeah, I just think it's pretty, like I said, it's returning back to the sci-fi plot,
yes,
right?
I love it.
So 500 years ago, epistemicide happened, knowledge systems were attacked, and, you know, through some, you know, really strategic coordination and religious hybridity, some ceremonies survived. You know, they were totally recodified to survive religious colonialism. And they were preserved in some communities in Mesoamerica. And what blows my mind is that now it's those who have access to the most venture capital, being white males, who are able to monopolize the marijuana and psilocybin industry. And, you know, it does jeopardize the survival of indigenous stewarded traditions when indigenous communities are under attack by organized crime that are displacing their territories for mega projects that are going to profit other imperial superpowers. So what happens if you have a futurist lens and you put on your futurist goggles and mm-hmm. you follow this trajectory of colonialism, what could potentially happen is total extermination and the total monopolization of these medicinal knowledges getting totally recodified as something that's Western, you know, through a Western framework, through a scientific language, you know, on microdosing or, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy. And that's all, you know, it's not to say that healing is nonlinear, because it is nonlinear. So sometimes we need to have these difficult conversations, but we need to make sure that we don't just leave indigenous communities out in the middle of war while other people become rich from medicine that
these people in the communities created, maintained, protected, risked things for.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. And yeah, also just really thinking about who has rights to this type of healing, who deserves this type of healing the most, even, because when I get back to the tech bro like analogy, it's kind of like, what, you know, we assume that people need this type of healing, or we as a collective like youthful American like culture often assume or maintain that it makes sense that after, you know, 40 to 80 hours a week spent in capitalism, that you, or, you know, spent actively advancing your piece of the capitalist pie, that you deserve the like shift in consciousness. You deserve this opportunity for healing in your own recreation, let's say. But thinking about what these indigenous communities deserve, and especially people originating from these communities and then entering the U.S. only to be met with state violence, as you're describing, it's really, really interesting.
So I'd like to add that there's a huge opportunity in creating a labor force to create the circumstances for everyone to have access to this generative medicine. You know, it's not impossible. And we really, you know, we talk about needing to create new jobs, and we talk about the healthcare crisis, and we don't talk enough about how the crisis on access to healthcare is also a crisis for needing to expand mental health services. And I think that there is a huge need for ecological restoration that is conducive to the growth of mushrooms. And there needs to be more conversations happening between the decrim movement in California and across the country, in conversation with indigenous communities south of the U.S.-Mexico border, because as my friend and I were talking about yesterday, this is multinational work that would be so beneficial to everyone. And something I wanted to highlight that I learned at the Drug Policy Alliance's International Reform Conference was that the amount of opioid use in Tijuana along the U.S.-Mexico border is really high amongst deported people. So of the people who visited a needle exchange in Zona Norte in Tijuana, which is right next to the U.S. port of entry in Tijuana, 67% of those who came to the needle exchange for services were deported from the United States. Mm. And I just really want to emphasize in my work in accompanying folks that are seeking asylum or who have been released from the detention system, there's a huge need for access for healthcare that isn't there is no capacity to supply for. And I have witnessed folks who have needed to resort to self-medicating, to taking matters into their own hands. So again, I just really want to emphasize that people using drugs are self-medicating, you know, to make living another day possible, because sometimes it's just too painful. And I think it does really speak volumes that there's a high percentage of deported people that are using drugs. And it's a public health issue to go through such a cruel system and not have mental health resources upon release.
Right. And when we speak about, you raised the idea earlier of just like the costs of these different political happenings, these different systems, and that statistic in regards to opiate use among deported people at the border is just one tiny iteration of so many, like, you know, costs beyond what we can count, right, in terms of how this impacts people's lives.
Absolutely. And then something I'd also like to propose to the listener is, what if we used money that gets funneled into the Department of Defense and we use that money instead on funding psychedelic assisted psychotherapy for everyone who that makes sense to?
Right.
That would be a totally different world. Can you imagine sending funding instead of sending military aid, foreign military aid? Can you imagine sending money for healthcare systems abroad to begin implementing systems to capacitate psychedelic therapists?
Right.
That would be a totally different world.
It would be so beautiful, and also would be respectful of this like system of knowledge that these same systems have, you know, specifically like disintegrated from our lives.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would for certain have to be done in consultation with Indigenous communities, of course.
Right. And you spoke about this to a degree when you're talking about meeting the co-founders, but there's also just the beyond the – I don't know if it's beyond, but, like, there's the war on drugs narrative of this and, like, the human costs. And but then there's also just, like, the realities of the plant material itself. And so, like, what does it mean for certain places to be extracted, like you mentioned, over periods of time? And so I also appreciate what your organization does in terms of, like, protecting protecting those sites of production.
So we're still in our very early stages of doing that. And, you know, if there's any listeners out there that feel super inspired, there is a need to create reserves, ecological reserves, to protect, to even reforest. Mm-hmm. In some places, for example, in Oaxaca, there needs to be, you know, some collective land purchase and stewardship and tree planting that would be conducive to certain species of mushrooms surviving, because there is a drought that has been plaguing Huautla, the Jimenez in Oaxaca. So during the peak of mushroom growth season during the summer, like July, there hasn't been as many mushrooms of a particular species growing as much as there used to be. And yet psychedelic tourism continues. And because of psychedelic tourism and how things have played out in the local community, there is a lot of economic dependence on psychedelic tourism. But there's also depletion happening of the mushroom supply. So I think that there is a need for collective brainstorming and collective resource sharing, so that communities are resourced to provide medicine for their own community, and if they wish to share those practices with others.
Thank you. And I'm very interested in this discourse because I am such a proponent of psilocybin mushrooms. I want to make clear. And I also recognize my privilege. I have been to Oaxaca, but I actually didn't pursue psychedelic tourism there. But I have specifically been in Mexico many times doing mushrooms the entire time. And I know what that kind of pleasure or healing feels like. But I also am aware that because of that knowledge, there's even more of an incentive to not think that, like, I deserve it more than other people, or that this isn't something that should be, like, a universal, you know, access point in terms of health and healing.
What I really appreciate about one of the co-founders of the organization, and this was what inspired me to reach out to him, is that he believed that Huautla Jimenez should be recognized as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO, yes, and that the psilocybin mushroom should be recognized as cultural patrimony and medicine for humanity. And I was all for it. Question mark is, what does that mean, especially when there are people who are looking to patent synthesized psilocybin and where there are people who want to profit. But I think if there's one thing that mushrooms can teach us is that they're untamable. You know, right, they're popular medicine. It's a pretty DIY model that folks can, invest in collective mushroom growing techniques and cultivation. So I think the mycelial networks resist monopolization in that way.
I'm learning about that more and more each day, it seems. Those are crazy networks. What did I want to ask? I was wondering if, because like we're talking about this issue ongoing, present day issue in Oaxaca, but I'm wondering if maybe between the two of us we can piece together a little bit of the history of like the global extraction of mushrooms in Oaxaca. I'm kind of referring to like Robert Gordon Wasson and just this idea that you taught me in the past, which is that even in the past, that like ever since this global tradition or these indigenous traditions have been, ever since these indigenous traditions have experienced global visibility, they've become in jeopardy, or like they're more in danger because of like the global awareness of these localized practices and ceremonies. And so we're talking about that now, but it seems like that really began right away in terms of like the first kind of white or white American visitors to that region of Oaxaca. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. It's fascinating. So there was a man named Robert Waitlander who published the first scholarly article on the ceremonial use by the Mazatec people of psilocybin mushrooms, occult mushroom ceremonies. And Robert Gordon Wasson was a Wall Street banker, and him and his partner Valentina were mushroom enthusiasts and had pursued independent research into mushrooms. And this is at a time in history in which a lot of Europeans or Caucasians living in the U.S. Had a lot of hobbies. You know, they had their main
leisure,
right? They had their main jobs. And so the Wasson's hobby was mycology and ethnomycology. And so they reached out to Robert Waitlander about the article that they had read, and they started communicating. And it was the Waitlanders who supported the Wasson's and facilitated their trip to Huautla de Jimenez in 1957, or perhaps it was a few years before that. I would have
to. Yeah, 55, 57.
Yeah. Like that. Excellent. Thank you. So, from my understanding, there's contested narratives right now. And part of, I would instead like to highlight that right now I'm participating in a process, in a historical process to demystify the encounters that happened, the sequence of events that happened mm-hmm. in that time period. I'm accompanying an effort that seeks to, that is truth-seeking in the events that happened there. So I think right now we're in that stage. But one thing that is pretty for certain is that there was an article in Life magazine that was published on Maria Sabina's mushroom ceremonies. And Maria Sabina is a Mazatec mushroom priestess who facilitated ceremonies. She began eating psilocybin mushrooms at a very young age, much like many Mazatec folks have. And she would curate ceremonies and sing quite feminist songs, affirming feminine power.
Mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he published an article in Life magazine in 1957 without her consent. It created this new global consciousness of these ceremonies that a bunch of predominantly white hippies had a huge appetite for. So they flocked to the pueblo that had been previously isolated from external, from contact with the external world. And it created a
the situation we're in now, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A long hair, like a long lineage of this kind of like psychedelic tourism and the way that it has impacted the local community's access to the medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have to, I feel like I still have much more relationship building to do, but what I can say is that folks in Huautla don't have access to basic needs such as healthcare. Education is limited. There are limited educational opportunities. There is an increasing challenge with substance dependency in the community. And in my time that I've been building relationships there, one healer that I intended to see passed away, and another person that I recently met during my last trip has a pulmonary disease, and he is one of the folks who has a pretty grounded understanding of the Mazatec tradition with the psilocybin ceremonies. So there's just a great risk for loss of cultural ancestral knowledge. And I guess contact with the external world played a big role in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a thinking about the Maria Sabina situation and the visitors that ended up publishing their experience in Life magazine. It's such a time capsule narrative to me, because our world is just so immediate and connected now that it's just so fucking like quaint. But the idea that one visitor, like one camera, one documentation can lead to just such a shift in human awareness or global awareness of something, it's just like kind of blows my mind, and also reminds me of just like photography as a facet of colonialism and like depictions, and just how when you read about like 19th century or early 20th century ideas of like what cameras do and what like capturing reality does to the people there, it just provides me a lot of like thematic thought around all that stuff, because this, it's like they were going through a ceremony, they had the privilege and the invitation, or like the permission at least, to participate in such a ceremony. And I don't know if we mentioned it right now, but it was even perhaps found that there was lies being told in order to gain access to that medicine, that perhaps these American visitors lied about their like personal experiences in order to be deemed like valid to receive the medicine. And yeah, just like thinking about all that is really interesting to me, because it just feels like so contemporary and yet also such a time capsule.
Absolutely. And one thing I'd add is that Maria Sabina's story is just an emblematic?
Yeah. Emblematic?
Emblematic, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that Maria Sabina's story is emblematic because she was exploited by many people, and she died a poor woman, and she performed so many healing ceremonies, and was just much like the patterns of extraction that are jeopardizing our collective survival. This story of this healer is emblematic of how we treat the earth, and how we, how white supremacists treat indigenous people. And this healer, this mushroom priestess, was totally objectified and was turned into an icon that she didn't ask to become. And so I just think that we're still on that trajectory with how the mushrooms are being treated, and with how indigenous cultures are being treated, in which indigenous people are expected to perform healings or to provide medicine or to, you know, play a particular kind of role for the healing of Westerners, whereas there's questionable motives behind people's desire to transform, when in fact they could be really transforming their relationships by acting in solidarity with the struggles of indigenous people.
Yes, thank you so much. And yeah, the idea that like literally white American businessmen were like not respecting the consent of an Indigenous healer. I mean, it's just all like shows that none of these systems of oppression are new. Like, none of it is new. All of these stories are old, I think, mm-hmm. to the biggest extent. And unfortunately, like, our education system isn't really like up to par in terms of providing people with access to old stories that can tell us about the new ones, you know, at least a lot of the time. Well, the hope is one day plant medicine access could function as a form of reparations, which is yes. an idea you enlightened me to. Thank you. And that when we think about, like, self-healing, like, why is it self-healing? You know, like, are these mushroom trips are for, like, you know, getting in touch with your inner child, but, like, what about the community's inner child, you know, or how mm. – what kind of collective healing? Because, like – I don't know. I don't see a lot of American youth that already enjoy psilocybin mushrooms, let's say. Like, I don't know that they're going to stop using them. But is there something about the way we experience, discuss, purchase, you know, like, there might be other considerations for how we go about our relationship to that. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And the conversations that we have with youth who are super inclined to experiment, who hold great curiosity for mind expanding experiences. Right. I know for myself, I was very curious. And speaking of, you know, San Fernando Valley local politics.
Yes.
I would say that when we were growing up, there was a very high use of psychoactive substances.
Hell yeah.
A lot of people were using drugs in middle school and high school.
Especially where you went to middle school. Just knowing your – I just feel like when I went to high school, I was introduced to a whole community from other middle schools, including the place you went, where it was like people were just doing acid in seventh grade and like sitting in class and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like ready to catch up because everyone was all cool and doing drugs.
Right. And we, you know, if I reflect on my upbringing in the San Fernando Valley, while there was so many psychoactive substances available to us, I would have benefited so much from having more guidance, more destigmatized guidance and honest conversations about drugs. Like, we didn't have that. And many of us were attending electronic music concerts.
Hell yeah, we were.
You know, peace, love, unity, respect.
Yeah.
But there weren't many folks telling us about, you know, what certain drugs would, how they would impact our mental health or
harm reduction,
how we could mitigate the impacts of some of those drugs, or how, you know,
the come downs. Yeah,
exactly. Or how there's even kits where you can test what
pills. Or...
Yeah, exactly. So I think moving forward, we really need to have more healthy conversations with our youth who are going to have to make the decision themselves whether they try something or not. And it's super important to incorporate that in public education.
Right. And not stigmatizing anything more than another. And it's just funny. I feel like being in an office environment for the first time in my life, like when I, during a period of time where I showed up to a more corporate office every day, that's what really showed – it almost like gave me an invitation to do whatever drugs I wanted whenever I wanted, mm-hmm. which isn't to say that was very plentiful or active, you know, just in my own choices. But with weed, yeah, it was, because I just got this – I was able to visualize through either perception or through my personal relationships and transparency with all of these diverse colleagues that – it's just felt like everybody is doing something sometimes, and whether that's every day or, you know, like there's just so many types of drugs. And like, not, I'm saying all that because it's like with teenagers, like we can assume that some choices or some experimentation, we can like qualify that as like normal or typical, when doing so is just at a disservice to those youth, because the reality is that this scope of that is way beyond those, you know, was beyond weed and booze. You know what I mean? People are doing Molly and shrooms and like, in a lot of situations, way more in terms of, you know, prescription narcotics and et cetera. So,
right.
I really agree with you.
And there's a lot to say about how we talk about drugs, right? Because there's the prescribing of amphetamines to children in elementary school for being quote unquote hyperactive. And we don't realize that mental challenges in mental health begin in early childhood. Sometimes they advance in middle school or high school, but those are some really challenging developmental years for us. And that's when many people, you know, begin self-medicating to try to alleviate social anxiety or depression, or, you know, literally wanting to make form close-knit friendships and communities. So I think we really need to destigmatize our conversations around drug use, because it begins to drill this message at an early age that people who use drugs are not valuable to society and are unworthy of basic human rights. And fast forward to an individual that starts to receive this messaging at a young age, perhaps 12 years old, or perhaps, you know, in high school, they receive messaging that because they use some form of psychoactive substance that they're unworthy and that they're a criminal, et cetera, that they're never going to have a future. Mm-hmm. That puts them on a trajectory of failure and being system
shame and harm.
Yeah, having many encounters with law enforcement and policing and whatnot, and you know, creating this logic that certain people are disposable and not worthy of basic human rights like housing and healthcare.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so we're gonna wrap up soon, but I don't think we are underemphasizing, but I want to overemphasize that you're currently running for a seat in the House of Representatives representing the 30th District of California, which is the one and only San Fernando Valley, the area code of which I have tattooed on my left hip, 818.
Ooh, sensual.
Right, sensual politics.
Yes. Hashtag sensual politics.
You mentioned plur. It was a joke, but true, where I wanted to tell you, you definitely have the most plur political campaign of all time.
Wow, that is a badge of honor. Thank you.
I love that. What do you love about the Valley?
You know, when I was younger, I was a little bummed that I was so far away from the activity. And
the city life.
I wanted to be in the center.
Over the hill.
All those late night parties.
Right.
But then, you know, upon returning from my undergraduate studies, I would be driving some mornings, either the 101 or the 405, and I would have this beautiful view of the blue
skies. It's like Lord of the Rings over there sometimes.
Right, and just surrounded by all these mountains, whether you look to the north and you see the mountain range around Sylmar, that mountain range is so beautiful.
Pretty. I love the 170.
Yes, and my mom used to run those mountains, and then looking to the south and seeing the mountain range around Burbank, and on the other side is the San Gabriel Valley, and then seeing the mountain range, the Hollywood Hills, and all of it's so green and lush. And
Topanga Canyon
State Park, up Reseda, there's a lot of biodiversity there too, and Balboa Park, and just seeing all of these sites of rich biodiversity in the San Fernando Valley just plugs me into how the San Fernando Valley is indigenous to Tavium land, and it hasn't been totally exterminated yet. And that's what gives me life about remaining in the valley, is that it's indigenous to Tavium land, and there's still palpable trees that are breathing life into our air.
That have been there for so long.
Yeah.
I've been to, like, the center. It's on, like, Ventura and Balboa, I think, in Encino. And it's, like, a natural water source that has been there since those indigenous times, like that. And then became, during colonial times, like, a spot on, like, settlers' journeys to get water. And it's just, like, across from the Equinox now, you know? So it's interesting. But they sell little pamphlets there that's like micro history of Sherman Oaks or micro history of the Valley. And I love connecting with the idea that, I don't know, just that nothing's brand new and that everywhere has history. And I think particularly in LA and like the surrounding LA community, that people have a lot of obsession with LA as like a futurist place. And it's seemingly always been that way, where it's like popping off as something new and a place where history and status and legacy and lineage doesn't matter as much as other places, at least in the American tradition. So I just feel like there isn't a lot of reverence for the past. So I like that you mentioned reverence for the literal, physical, geographical plane, because all of those valley vistas and all of those mountains mm-hmm. are so pretty. Absolutely. And I enjoy them every day. And the idea of like suburbs as wasteland is like, I think it's fucked up, especially because even if like the idea that like the valley or suburb was created as like white flight destinations, I feel at this point in time that has been uprooted or upended a lot, you know, and the population that you would hopefully serve in Congress is a population that I think is so beautiful, that is full of so much authentic diversity.
Absolutely. We have communities from all over the world in the San Fernando Valley.
In our classrooms, in our schools, and that's really cool. And I think that, especially as a white person, like, as we know, proximity to people of color means nothing in terms of your own identity or your own contributions to society, but just like recognizing that that's actually a privilege that a lot of other white people don't have growing up, especially in the suburbs in this country, that there's so much like racial isolation and alienation in that way. I'm really appreciative of the classrooms that we came up in, and I really can't emphasize enough how much our public high school education in LA informed who I am to such an insane level.
Same. I literally wouldn't be here with the language I have. And
right.
Yeah.
And how that language changes how we feel about ourselves too.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly around the American Studies unit in 11th grade, that is race and class and gender and sexuality. But beyond that too, like I remember I took aesthetics in 12th grade, which is basically like studying how the greatest artists and critics of like Western culture felt about the role and purpose of art. And as a creative person at like, you know, 17 or whatever, that gave me so much agency and freedom about how I use language to like create and describe who I am in comparison to who I wanted to be. And it's just so major. So I'm appreciative.
Absolutely. Same.
And look at the quality of mentors you mentioned from Cleveland police, Patrice Cullors, who is working to end police violence in LA and who's obviously gained global attention as a leader in Black Lives Matter. Just the caliber of people we engaged with at that time, yourself included, just continue to be so bountiful in my life.
Honestly, yeah, Cleveland Humanities Magnet has invested so much in its students. I wish that it wasn't just through the Magnet School program that people would receive access to ethnic studies, gender studies.
And right.
That was one thing that was unfortunate, was that we received a segregated education. And I just wish that more education policy makers look to Cleveland Humanities Magnet to source some inspiration for what education for everyone can look like.
Right. Shouts out Neil Anstead, the creator of the humanities program for all of Los Angeles, actually, including our high school, who I interviewed last year for my own personal interest. And he had gone blind in one eye by going back to volunteer substitute like a million years after retiring to teach poetry because he's so good at it. He was reading the kids a Winnie the Pooh poem and then he realized he couldn't see it. And I'm just like, beautiful, heartbreaking image of this man who's devoted his life to like amplifying arts education. So beautiful. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll be teachers one day, but Paul is pretty much going to be busy in Congress and beyond.
Yes. May the path open up for us.
Thank you so much for being here today, Paula. I wish you nothing but luck and success on this campaign and beyond. And I am excited to organize some of our listeners into supporting your work.
Thank you, Tierney. It's been a pleasure to join you today. And it's so lovely to synthesize our combined knowledges together.
A privilege. Hey, it's me again. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Paula Kahn. It was such an honor to record this episode with somebody so smart and so dedicated to spreading this kind of information to her community and beyond. Please follow Paula at PaulaKahn2020 on Instagram. That's at PaulaKahn2020. Whether it's $15, $5, or $50, please consider donating what you can to Paula's congressional campaign. The link to do so is in her bio. I really believe that we all deserve candidates who speak to the idea of a just transition in the way that Paula does. Candidates that give us an opportunity to imagine ourselves and people we love feeling protected and included in the campaigns and administration of our elected officials. It would be so beautiful to begin that just transition with Paula representing us. So I want to especially encourage my Valley listeners, my hometown heroes, to please, please, please keep Paula's campaign at the top of your mind and to provide anything you can in support. Keep on listening, and until next time, XOXO, Tierney. We'll be right back.